This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. When Rebecca Clayfish entered the race for governor, she was the presumed Republican frontrunner. But now the former lieutenant governor may be at risk of losing her primary campaign. As she closes out the race, she's reminding voters of the work she did with former Governor Scott Walker more than a decade ago. As Sean Johnson reports, the question now is whether that will work.
There have been big events during Rebecca Clayfish's 2022 run for governor that have not broken her way. But in the closing weeks of her primary campaign, there are little moments that have Clayfish feeling like it's 2010 all over again. During an interview at a recent GOP picnic in Verona, Clayfish gets interrupted from across the park, but in a good way.
You know, we put... Thank you. Love you guys. Tell your friends August 9th, please.
Clayfish says moments like these remind her of her first run for office in 2010.
And there was a moment at which you could feel almost palpable momentum on the ground, and it's stuff like that.
2010 was the year Clayfish jumped headfirst into politics. She won a crowded GOP primary for lieutenant governor and joined Scott Walker's ticket. She was there in 2011 when Walker introduced Act 10, his landmark bill that all but eliminated public sector union rights. And they both survived historic recall elections in 2012.
Now this is what democracy looks like!
After Walker narrowly lost to Democratic Governor Tony Evers in 2018 and later announced he would not run in 2022, Clayfish became the presumed frontrunner. She's since been endorsed by a long list of Republican power brokers, including Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, the business giant Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, and most prominently, Walker.
Hi, I'm Scott Walker. Please join me in voting for Rebecca Clayfish for governor. Rebecca stood with me as we took on the big government special interest and cut taxes.
With each endorsement has come an overt reminder that Clayfish was there a decade ago when Republicans won control of state government and fundamentally changed Wisconsin. Longtime GOP operative Brian Schimming says it's an effective way for Clayfish to remind voters of her record.
You know, there's a reason she's got him out front as much as she does, and that is he still is very powerful motivator with Republican primary voters. And the grassroots, 100% name ID.
But Schimming says there are reasons Walker's support and Clayfish's record weren't enough to clear the field. Being lieutenant governor isn't quite the same as being governor, he says. There's also the old adage.
For some folks, it's the oldest thing in the book. That was then and this is now. And
the Republican Party of 2022 is different from the party of 2010. Walker and Clayfish won with a base of support in the suburbs. Republicans still turn out the vote there, but not by quite as much. Meanwhile, at least some GOP voters actively dislike all of Clayfish's establishment ties. Lily Gorin is a professor of political science at Carroll University in Waukesha.
Those who were standard bearers before are not necessarily in the positions that they had been in terms of what their endorsements mean, what kind of popularity they have.
Clayfish also missed out on the biggest endorsement when former President Donald Trump backed her opponent, construction executive Tim Michels. Michels, who only entered the race in April, has since spent millions of his own money on ads and shot up in the polls. But when asked why she wasn't able to put this race away earlier, Clayfish rejects the premise of the question.
Nobody's entitled to anything. Things must be earned, and there's no one who can outwork me.
That was who she was in 2010, Clayfish says. That's who she is now. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
WPR is running a series of profiles ahead of Wisconsin's August 9th primary election. We'll continue to profile Republicans running for governor over the course of this week. Now, U.S. Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi has planned a trip to Taiwan next month, creating political controversy in China and in the U.S. The Chinese government has threatened consequences if Pelosi visits the island. Taiwan is self-governing, but China claims it as its own. President Biden has said the U.S. military does have some concerns about the proposed trip. An official of Pelosi's rank hasn't visited Taiwan in over 25 years since the Republican House Speaker Newt Gingrich made the trip. Her planned visit comes at a time when tensions between the U.S. and China are high. You can join the show at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. Should the U.S. play a strong role in supporting Taiwan? Do you worry about provocation from China in the region? What do you want to know about how Taiwan fits into U.S.-China relations? Call 800 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Rosalind Shea is an associate professor of political science at Temple University, where she co-directs the Certificate in Political Economy. Her new book is called Micro-Institutional Foundations of Capitalism, Sectoral Pathways to Globalization in China, India, and Russia. Rosalind, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into the latest news this week, a big picture. Taiwan is in a very unique position. It is an independently functioning government. China claims it. A lot of the world has to sort of pretend it doesn't exist and yet interact with it. Can you talk about the status of Taiwan a little bit?
Yeah, so as you mentioned already, Taiwan is an independent governing country, and in many ways it is independent and sovereign. It has its own economy, it has its own military, and so one way to kind of periodize U.S.-China relations, U.S.-China-Taiwan relations, would be to look back a few decades into the end of the 1970s. That's in 1978 when the United States normalized diplomatic relations with the People's Republic of China. And that was at the time during Jimmy Carter's administration when the Taiwan Relations Act was voted into law by the US Congress. And so essentially since the normalization of diplomatic relations and the Taiwan Relations Act, the United States in many ways have danced around this kind of policy of strategic ambiguity, in the sense that we, the United States, engages diplomatically and economically with China, which at that time was about to, open its open door policy and integrating into the global economy. But because of China's claim over the sovereignty of Taiwan, the United States officially has diplomatic relations with Taiwan, nor does it officially recognize Taiwan's independence, even though, as you mentioned, Taiwan is independently governed.
So why would China be particularly concerned about a U.S. Speaker of the House and other members of Congress paying an official visit to Taiwan?
So, in China's mind, having kind of one of the top executive officials, elected officials in the United States visit, as you mentioned earlier, the last time was in 1997 when Newt Gingrich visited Taiwan. To have a top official visit, in their mind, it is, essentially the United States officially diplomatically engaging Taiwan. And, with China's sovereign claim over Taiwan, this is something that China is unhappy about. But, in many ways, we could characterize what Pelosi is doing and situating it in what the Fed President Janet Yellen spoke about or recently advocated, which is what she called friend shoring. And this is the idea that we focus on trading and investing with our allies and not our geopolitical rivals. And so Pelosi going to Taiwan, taking a trip to an allied country, is in a sense recognizing Taiwan as an important node of the global supply chain. So in some ways, it is not about, intentionally provocating China, but rather, executing what the U.S. Economically, strategically is doing, which is focusing on trading and investing with our allies during a time of war.
Rosalind Shea is with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at Temple University, looking at U.S.-China relations and Taiwan as House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and possibly other members of Congress looking at a possible visit to Taiwan next month. China not happy about the notion, the leadership there. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see from U.S. foreign policy when it comes to China? What questions do you have about this fairly sensitive and complicated bit of U.S. foreign policy and how it affects our economy, too? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up our talk about Taiwan and U.S.-China relations with Rosalind Shea, Associate Professor of Political Science at Temple University. Things are tense already. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi looking at a possible trip to Taiwan. China criticizing that notion. Concerns about some sort of military escalation or at least provocation. You could join in with your thoughts on all that, your questions for our guest right now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Rosalind, I assume, or I understand, internally in China now, there's a big deal coming up, a big party meeting where President Xi Jinping is looking at trying to have an unprecedented third term as president of that country. How important is that timing when it comes to China's reaction to this planned trip to Taiwan?
And certainly with the party congress coming up, Xi Jinping will have to appear to the domestic audience that he is taking a strong stance in regards to any quote-unquote provocations in regards to Taiwan. And, you know, with the geopolitical tensions right now, in many ways, Xi Jinping is forced to do, rhetorically anyway, to respond to what China is now characterizing as provocations. Now, in terms of what really, in fact, may in fact happen, I do not believe, and developments do not reveal that, in fact, China will, you know, will act militarily just because Nancy Pelosi takes this trip to Taiwan.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Franklin. Mike, hi.
Hi. I'm wondering if we could have a little conversation. If we are going to take diplomatic approaches towards situations, and as situations get more and more tenuous, what is the status of our ability to have really good diplomacy on a world scale?
Mike, thanks for the call. Rosalind, can you talk about the state of U.S. diplomacy, our relationships with China? I know President Biden, I believe, expected to talk to the Chinese president as soon as tomorrow.
Yeah, I do think that, you know, we do have, you know, open dialogue with China. In fact, as, you know, planned, Biden will have a conversation with Xi Jinping tomorrow. And in terms of relations with our allies around the world, the Asia Pacific, in particular, in May, when Biden visited Asia, he rolled out the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, which is essentially focused on diplomatic relations with countries in Asia, with the objective of diversifying supply chains and markets for the U.S. And in part, it is, you know, in light of the geopolitical situation with the war going on in Russia and Ukraine, but it's also in response to Biden administration's response to what the China's increasingly closed economy focused on promoting indigenous industry that it can control. And so, as I have written about in my previous book, China's Regulatory State, and then also in my new book, Microinstitutional Foundations of Capitalism, what we have seen is that since that open door policy in 1978 that I mentioned earlier, China has really taken a liberalization two-step, which is, you know, it integrating into the global economy, part of being part of the WTO, courting foreign direct investment, but then all around the same time in parallel re-regulating. And so we had the Trump administration, for example, responding to that re-regulation, that kind of closing in of the Chinese markets and trade to foreign direct investment. The Trump administration responded to that with the U.S.-China trade war. Biden, on the other hand, is now focusing on what he's calling Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, which is diversifying supply chains and having more of a emphasis on trade relationship with Asia Pacific. And along the same lines, as I mentioned earlier, the Fed president, Janet Yellen, is now advocating friendshoring. And so it's all along that same lines of let's focus on relationship, economic and political, diplomatic with our allies in the Asia Pacific, as well as our allies around the world. And by doing so, then we could face our geopolitical rivals.
Mike, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Chris joins us now in La Crosse. Chris, hello.
Yeah, hello. How are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Chris?
Well, I in 2012, I was out at Fort Lee, Virginia at the Logistics University for the military, and we had military guests from Taiwan there, and I was just curious, is how has the relationship changed from then to now if they're not recognized as their own entity, and or am I incorrect in understanding that, or what's going on there?
Chris, thanks for the call. Rosalind, as I understand it, the U.S. does supply military supplies to Taiwan. The kind of cooperative training exercises Chris mentioned, I think, might still go on, even though, again, we don't necessarily say Taiwan is a country.
Right. You're certainly right. In the context of strategic ambiguity, we also have in parallel the Taiwan Relations Act, which was voted into law in the U.S. Congress in 1978. And essentially, the Taiwan Relations Act commits the United States to selling weapons to Taiwan to maintain its self-defense capabilities, and it also empowers the United States to, you know, appropriately decide, U.S. Congress and the president together, to appropriately decide if for any reason that self-defense capacity changes in order to maintain peace and security in the Western Pacific area. And so indeed, the Taiwan Relations Act maintains military exercises, the selling of weapons to Taiwan for self-defense capabilities. And if, you know, that kind of defense, self-defense orientation changes, then the president and the United States Congress together can appropriately decide on solutions, and which could include military if it means that we need to do that to maintain peace and security. And all of this is empowered by the Taiwan Relations Act.
Chris, thanks for calling in. We're talking to Rosalind Shea from Temple University, looking at U.S.-China relations, Taiwan, a possible visit by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and other members of Congress there next month, and objections from Chinese leadership to that possible visit. Rosalind, you mentioned military action from China you don't see as being very likely. One scenario that has people concerned is that China might step up its claims to waterways that most of the world looks at international waters. China says, nope, Chinese waters, and trying to assert that in some way, you know, not a full on military escalation, but something that would be worrisome, economically disruptive at the very least. Do you see that as a possible response from China?
You know, it's always possible. And in many ways, for those of us who've been watching developments around the world, China has already began to do such steps in other parts of the world, including in and around the Arctic Circle. And so if China does indeed do that, that wouldn't be something that's necessarily new. If China does do that, you know, that it would be considered by the United States as a provocation began by China. And again, relying on the Taiwan Relations Act, that would disrupt the self-defense capability of Taiwan.
We had a comment from Chris in Reedsburg, who is asking for a little overview of why China and Taiwan are in this situation in the first place, where they're separate countries, but China claims Taiwan. Can you sum up some of the early history that led to this current situation?
Yeah, so, you know, we could begin with the end of World War II. The current, you know, the Republic of China government that's on Taiwan, which actually had ruled Taiwan under martial law for 40 years and underwent democratic transition in the 1990s, that Republic of China government was headed by Chiang Kai-shek, and Chiang Kai-shek was in a civil war with Mao Zedong in the People's Republic of China, what, you know, called mainland China, until the end of the Chinese Civil War and the end of World War II. And at that time, the United States, Chiang Kai-shek being an ally of the United States, and at the end of World War II, the United States essentially permitted the control of Taiwan to Chiang Kai-shek. And so since Chiang Kai-shek went to Taiwan in 1949, Taiwan and China have been governed separately. And in fact, really, Taiwan has been governed separately since the end of the 19th century in 1895 when, you know, Japan came under, when Taiwan came under Japanese colonial control at the end of the Russo-Japanese War. But, you know, let's not go all the way back. Let's just focus on World War
II. Rosalind, are you still
half
there?
Half century and beyond. Yes, I'm here. Essentially, in the last half century and beyond, Taiwan and China have been governed separately, and China has been laying claims over Taiwan.
In just our last minute or so, Rosalind, what are you watching for next as this story moves ahead over the next couple of weeks?
Yeah, I'm watching to see what, you know, whether Nancy Pelosi will indeed take this trip, whether the Biden administration and Nancy Pelosi, Janet Yellen, and other administrators would be able to characterize and frame this trip as really about promoting global liberalism, about promoting, you know, investing and trading with our allies, and really, you know, painting a picture and framing this about the United States being for free trade and democracy.
Rosalind, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Rosalind Shea is an associate professor of political science at Temple University. She talked to us about House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's potential trip to Taiwan and how it's highlighted current tensions in the U.S. relationship with China. Now, you might have heard of farm to table, but what about grain to glass? Beer has a long and complex history in our state. Old World Wisconsin is exploring that history and actually making beer from historic recipes that visitors can taste on site. Rob Novak is the Brewing Experience Program Coordinator at Old World Wisconsin. Rob, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Can you give us a taste of what we'll experience when we visit the Brewing Experience?
Yeah, so what you'll find is the newest building on site, which is actually brewing some of the oldest beer in the state. And what we have is a beautiful space to really do some experimental beer archaeology with the tools and techniques that farmers would have had in Wisconsin from 1850 or 1860 to about 1900.
I think when people think of Wisconsin beer, they think of the big brand names that came along after this time period you're talking about. What was the beer scene like in Wisconsin before those big names kind of took over?
Well, it really wasn't too different than it is today, where we have small breweries in almost every town. Back then, they would have had small production breweries, mostly German, so the variety would not be the same, but they had small breweries. And you got to remember that they couldn't send beer long distances until they had refrigerated rail cars. So every town had to have a brewery. Before that time, farmers themselves did the brewing. So no matter where they were from, they had their own beer traditions and they try to recreate them in their kitchens.
How do you go about finding these old beer recipes?
The recipes are tricky. We know the styles and we know how they've evolved. Every once in a while, we'll find a recipe that falls out of a book or that we can find in a very old journal or something like that. But for the most part, we look at the ingredients they would have had, the time of year they would have been brewing, where they were from, and we do have to kind of piece them together and kind of reverse engineer them to try to get the flavors that they experienced.
I've known home brewers, and even though they're doing it on a small scale, they're taking advantage of modern technology in some ways. What are some of the maybe fundamental differences of an 1800s home brewer? What are some of the challenges that they might face, that you might face, trying to do it the way they did?
Well, they would have needed to provide all their own ingredients. So they're growing the barley, mostly barley. They're malting it themselves. They're growing the hops, or they're using other spices, other herbs to spice their beers. And while yeast wasn't fully understood yet, they were using yeast, but they would have gotten it from a neighbor, or they would have used maybe a baker's yeast in some cases. So really it was just ingenuity, farmers' ingenuity to create the beverage. The tools they would have used would have been either handcrafted or utilized for other purposes most of the time. But it's really all those factors coming together to make beer.
Rob Novak is with us, director of the brewing experience at Old World Wisconsin, telling us about making beers like Wisconsin made them back in the 1800s. Can you tell us about a couple of the brews you've been working on, Rob?
Well, one that we brew often is a cream ale, and that recipe was revived by craft brewers recently because you're basically brewing with ale ingredients and ale yeast, but you're making a beer that has lager-like flavors, and that's because the German immigrants coming here wouldn't have had access to lager yeast immediately, so they would have used a lot of corn as a clean fermenting, light fermenting grain. Of course, corn is now used in a lot of American adjunct beers, but back then it would have been used as a primary ingredient to try to lighten the beer to make it more like the beer they remembered from home.
Where do you source your ingredients to try to recreate some of these older recipes?
Well, we grow our own hops here. We have five or six varieties growing, and we will add to that. Once we finish the next phase of the project, it will include a hop garden that has a lot of varieties, including some wild Wisconsin hops. We're planting a field of heirloom barley. It's going to take a few years to get enough seed. We'll have to replant it and then harvest it and then partner with the local maltster to malt it. Heirloom barley was a lot smaller. It was unmodified. Today's barleys are made for brewing, but the barley back then would have been trickier. For the yeast, we tend to reharvest, or we'll go to a local brewery and ask if we can snag some of their ale yeast from whatever they're brewing. And we put all those things together, and we make it work.
I'm going to throw a long shot out here for you, Rob. Suppose somebody's listening and says, you know, there's this old family diary or whatever where great-great-grandparents had their beer recipe. Do you want to see that if they have that?
Yeah, we definitely want to see it. Those are the funnest things. A lot of times the language is different, or there's measurements that are strange depending on where people are from. But yeah, because that, even if it's from Prohibition, it gives us a link to what was being brewed before then. And if we can start linking those together, we might be able to actually figure out what beer tasted like in 1860 and 1870. That's the big mystery. Once these things are consumed, it's all like maybe music back then. You just have no idea. It's a big mystery, and we're trying to solve that.
Rob, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you, Rob.
That's Rob Novak, director of the brewing experience at Old World Wisconsin, talking about his efforts to recreate Wisconsin beers of the 1800s. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about embracing new experiences.
Writer Jill Sisson Quinn and her son had a summer routine. They would go to their local lake for a chilly early morning swim almost every day. But last summer, they tried somewhere new. The experience opened Quinn's eyes to the joys of both new and old loves.
My go-to lake is Sunset in Portage County, a few minutes from my home. When my son was an infant, I planted his feet in its warm sand. I pushed him on the swing while he alternately dozed and watched green darners, belted kingfishers, and bald eagles. Even as, over the years, Sunset's water level rose, swallowing the beach, engulfing the swing set, and turning the picnic tables into strange diving platforms, we continued our near-daily summer visits. They began in late May, when I'd returned from my morning walk to my son waiting on the porch in his swim trunks. We'd arrive at Sunset before 8 a.m., alone but for one older couple who braved the icy water with us. But last summer, I cheated on Sunset. I enrolled my son in swimming lessons at Waupaca County's Shadow Lake, a farther drive to a more populated area. Shadow seemed a little less wild, with its slides, lifeguards, freeze pops, and flushable toilets. The water was more shallow and warm. Folks warned by summer's end there might be lots of goose poop. Cars ran visibly along a fairly busy road on the lake's western side. Because of this, I assumed there was a dam somewhere, and the lake was man-made. Gradually, we fell in love with Shadow. I watched the teenage swim instructors progress from organizing games of hula hoop tag to teaching my son the crawl. They showed him how to give himself over to the water, how a quick turn of the head and in-breath is all he really needs of the landed environment. There is something so right about watching high schoolers teach younger kids. A friend once summed it up for me. Teenagers so need to be loved, and children so love teenagers. We didn't visit Sunset for weeks. My son found a lost beach ball in the wetlands east of Shadow, and thus began pickup games of soccer before lessons. After class, he would play on the raft and the slide with whoever was there, girls and boys alike of varying ages, who barely knew each other's names, brought together by this lake. Some pretty natural things can happen at an unnatural lake, I left thinking one day, musing about my shifting love from sunset to shadow. But Shadow Lake is not man-made. Like sunset, it formed in a kettle depression left by the retreat of the last glacier, where a huge chunk of ice gradually melted in the newly laid sediment. The lake's only difference is how they get their water. A hardwater seepage lake, sunset's water comes mainly from groundwater. A drainage lake, Shadow has both an outlet and inlet, and receives water from precipitation, runoff, and another nearby lake. And both lakes have had humans' hands in them, suffered and benefited from our constant remodeling of the environment. Shadow Lake has had its channels renovated. Sunset has endured chemicals to kill off its entire fish population to be replaced with more desirable species. This reminds me that categories exist mostly in the mind. Natural, man-made, seepage, drainage, the lines between them often blurry. Nothing is pure. Passions can shift, and our preconceived ideas about one thing over another only limit our experience. After his final lesson, my son and I returned to Sunset Lake, and that original bond flooded through me like a dream of one's first love, from which you wake thinking still, this many years later, that was the one. And sunset seemed to forgive our fickleness. That day, unassisted for the first time, my son would swim all the way out to sunset's buoy, just him and the water and desire. And for that, I cannot deny, I have to thank Shadow.
Jill Sisson-Quinn is an author who teaches writing at Mid-State Technical College and lives in Scandinavia, Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Now, we recently received this Why Wisconsin question from a listener.
Hi, my name is Leah Jaber. I'm a senior at Madison East High School, and my question is, how exactly did Mount Hora become the troll capital of the world, and is the Norwegian culture still so alive and prevalent?
Central Time producer Tim Peterson visited the troll capital itself to get the story, and you'll be able to hear audio from that visit in a forthcoming Wisconsin Life piece. He also talked to Jim Leary, Emeritus Professor of Folklore and Scandinavian Studies at UW-Madison. Jim co-founded the Center for the Study of Upper Midwestern Cultures. He also happens to be a Mount Horeb resident since the late 1980s. Here's a listen to their conversation.
So, Jim, let's start with answering the second question first. When did the village of Mount Horeb become a center for Norwegian culture in Wisconsin?
Mount Horeb was a strong area of Norwegian settlement in the mid-19th century, along with the Koshkonong Prairie and around Stoughton, and Mount Horeb and the hinterland surrounding it and extending out to Blue Mounds was also an area of concentrated early Norwegian settlement. And then there was a kind of a second wave in the late 19th century with newcomers sometimes coming to work as hired workers for the more settled Norwegians. So it's right there in a kind of a little belt of historic Norwegian settlement.
And we're going to get to trolls, obviously, but what are some other elements of Norwegian culture that someone would see if they walk around or spend time in Mount Horeb?
Well, the face of the village has a lot that says Norwegian. On the east end, there's a big water tower with rosemaling, this stylized Norwegian floral painting, and there are banners on the light standards through the village that have rosemaling motifs and sometimes velkommen, you know, welcome in Norwegian. The little Chamber of Commerce building on the main street, and also the old kind of railroad depot rest area on what is now the bike trail, have motifs from Stavkirke or Stave churches, wooden churches. And then there's the prominent open house imports, the Scandinavian gift shop with trolls out front, and also a stabur, a Norwegian log storage building that Nels Diller made.
And that's, you know, things that we could see if we walked around today, but are there kind of things that were erected by these immigrants that you mentioned earlier and that are kind of still around, or has there been sort of a reimagining or trying to come back to that those cultural items in later times?
Well, both, really. Mm-hmm. You know, there is what specialists refer to as intangible cultural heritage, the stuff that, you know, is ephemeral, or you don't, it's not a building or something like that. So people having coffee saying expressions like oofta, these expressions of kind of amazement or exasperation, you know, telling an occasional oli and line yolk, and you know, slipping into dialect. There were old customs like julebocking, this kind of Christmas masquerading that used to happen well into the 1950s and early 60s in and around Mount Horeb, of dressing up and in disguise and barging in on your neighbors. There's a strong Sons of Norway Lodge. There's Norwegian Lutheran presence in several of the Lutheran churches. So all of that stuff is kind of intangible or behind the scenes, and you know, you have to experience it by being around. But then, you know, there's this public face, and so, you know, Mount Horeb, there are Swiss people, there are Germans, there are Irish, there are Cornish in the historical settlement, but a plurality of Norwegians. And of course, outside the village was Little Norway, a long-standing tourist site, and for maybe 30 years or so into the 90s, a little village pageant, Song of Norway, based on the life of Edvard Grieg, who composed, among other things, In the Hall of the Mountain King, with trolls. And so, you know, those kinds of public-facing elements that say Norwegian were there, and in the way that people associate New Glarus with Swiss identity, for example, there are these community identities that sometimes tie in with ethnicity, and Mount Horeb has chosen to promote Norwegianness.
We're talking with Jim Leary, Professor Emeritus of Folklore and Scandinavian Studies at UW-Madison, also a longtime Mount Horeb resident himself, and we're answering a Wisconsin question about Mount Horeb, its Norwegian culture, and its trolls. So, Jim, remind us from folklore, what exactly is a troll?
Well, trolls are these ugly and somewhat dim-witted and physically powerful ancient figures who are associated with Norway's pagan past, and often its environment, you know, dwelling in caves and mountains, and sometimes in forests. And they also tie in with other creatures, so-called underjordiske, these underground people, among them the huldr, the hidden people who sometimes have the appearances of good-looking human beings, but they have the tails of cows. And so, you know, there are different figures associated with the Norwegian landscape. And if you're out there and, you know, barging into their territory, in the case of trolls, you might be taken into the mountain, or they might come and raid your place if you're encroaching on theirs.
And so, I mean, that doesn't really sound like something you'd want to have lining the streets of your town necessarily, but that's the case in Mount Horeb. How did Mount Horeb actually become the troll capital officially of the world?
Well, that's, of course, a self-anointed regal title. But in the 70s, folks in Mount Horeb were realizing that the construction of the 18-151 bypass would route traffic away from their town, and how could they get people to come in? And so there was a meeting of minds about what kind of theme to emphasize, and they did surveys, and Norwegianness seemed to be something that they could ballyhoo a little bit. And then there's the clever play on words between tollway and trollway. You could take the trollway, you know, off of the main highway, and trolls, of course, have this long association with Norway, and they were particularly popularized in 19th century illustrated collections of folk tales by P.C. Asbjørnsen and Jørgen Mue. So the troll became this, in the 19th and early 20th century, this kind of visible symbol of Norwegian folklore, and people in Mount Horeb could draw on it. But, you know, you have this distance in time and space, and so, you know, the terrifying creature of the past that you might recoil from in horror becomes something, you know, friendly and cuddly, and little children want little troll toys with a goofy hair and rubbery skin rather than running away from them as sources of terrible nightmares.
And Jim, I have to ask you, do you have a favorite troll around Mount Horeb?
Ah, you know, I love Mike Feeney's old troll carvings.
Yes.
And then there was a magnificent person, Oljana Venden Kanin, mm-hmm. and she used to make little troll sculptures out of Sculpey and coat hangers, and she would make clothing for them. She also made Barbie clothes on the side, but she made them for people in the different professions in Mount Horeb. And so there'd be one in the barbershop and one in the dentist office and, you know, a dentist troll and a butcher shop troll. And I loved her work as well.
Mm. Jim, thank you so much for sharing this with us today.
My pleasure.
That was Jim Leary, Emeritus Professor of Folklore and Scandinavian Studies at UW-Madison. Central Time producer Tim Peterson talked to them about the history and prevalence of Norwegian culture in the village of Mount Horeb and why they've got such a thing for trolls. This conversation came from an audience question as part of the Why Scotson question. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future story. Go to wpr.org/whyscotson. That's like W-H-Y, Scotson.